Right, good afternoon. Yeah, are there questions?
Since I didn't get to figure out the irrational one, what's the hit on how to find that in, like, that relates to...
The one that if you have irrational numbers... I mean, in some way, it's a little bit messy approximation. What you do is if you round down, and you want to round down that you don't get that with the rounding, you don't get that another cut would become smaller. And you could do so probably if you look over all subsets and what would happen when you round down and you look at these are finitely many subsets which would include all possible cuts, subsets of edges which would include, that would include all possible cuts, and you want to make sure that you if they're not equal, unless two of them are exactly equal, they will differ by some number epsilon. And you take that epsilon and say you divide it by 3, so that it's less than half, and you round down to something. And you might need to take a little bit more care of the situation if you're adding numbers, so you might need to look individually at the elements there, so that they don't... so that the rounding doesn't change what is a cut. And then you use problem wrong sheet. Then you use problem 47. That's the one that every cut, minimal cut, is at capacity. That if you're rounding down, all the minimal cuts stay minimal cuts. That's basically what when you're changing the capacity to something, what you just want to make sure is the minimal cuts stay minimal cuts. There is nothing else which can become a minimal cut. Right? And you want to round down to something close enough that you can say that approximates the flow as much as I can. And if you have a flow for which the rounded cuts are minimal, then you can say, oh, if I unround, I will have a flow where these are still, where the unrounded flows along there are the flow at capacity, and thereby it's a maximal flow. And so the only thing what you have to do, and that is messy analysis type thing, and that's why it ended up as a homework problem I didn't, because I didn't want to write it out in detail, is you want to see how close do you need to round? And if it was individual numbers, if a cut was just a single edge, you would look at the differences between the capacities of the edges, take the minimum difference, divide it by 3, and round to something within that epsilon. Since you might have multiple edges, you might potentially have to be a little bit more careful in how things round with a sum, and but you can do that. What do you need to do that? Probably you want to divide furthermore by the maximum number of edges in the cut or so. That you even take care of that the worst how rounding errors can add up would be maximum rounding error for all of them, and yeah, that will, and that way you ensure that what is a minimum, what really is a minimum cut, remains a minimum cut after round. That's what the problem was, and really the only reason for having that problem is in some way to say, okay, if you want the maximum, yes, we have some situations where with rational things, if you do things stupidly, it could work badly. But if you have a way to get the maximum flow, don't bother about irrationality. You could round down I'm just not saying explicitly how close one would really have to round down, but one could round and get the result. And so there is really nothing special about irrational numbers. It's just the way we're approaching. What is important is that there are finitely many edges. But the way we are approaching it essentially just works for the rational numbers. Right, other questions? You're awake? Yeah? Good. Good. We had started with partitions last time, and so you will be very surprised with how we continue. Which, unless you have glanced at the notes and you see how the next chapter is called, or next section is called, I will be willing to bet you would not have guessed. So, you know what squares are. Right? Or quadratic numbers. One by one square, two by two square, three by three square. And what is the formula if we have an n by n square? There are n square such numbers. You might have seen other things. There is something called, there is a whole gaggle of them, which are called figurative numbers. You have numbers which give you some regular shape. So for example, if we do triangles, a one by one triangle of size 2, or if, what's the formula there for the number of points in a triangle? Okay, so if we do this, what would be the next thing to look at? It would be pentagons, right? So we can look at a 1 by 1 pentagon, and we have a pentagon of magnitude 1, and we can take a pentagon of magnitude 2. Let me draw lines just so you see the pattern, how we are building it. We are now going further here. 1, 2, 3. So we want that the side length of the pentagon, here it is, 0, 1, 2. Right, that's how we are growing. Okay, so that and these are pentagonal numbers. Does anyone have an idea about the formula without looking? Probably not. But I mean, you probably believe it's not that hard to do an induction proof for finding a formula. And the formula we get here is n times 3n minus 1 over 2. It's still roughly quadratic because we are in the plane. And one way what one could do is one could go on with hexagons, heptagons, and so on, and get formulas. That's something for undergraduate math club or even high school things. And that's where I don't want to go, but I want to apply this to partitions. Okay. And let me start more formally. This is section 2, and this section is called pentagonal numbers. Okay, let me define this. Definition: an integer n is pentagonal if n is of the form of the form k times 3k minus 1 over 2. And we say generalized pentagonal and here we would want a k greater or equal than 1, and generalized pentagonal, if we allow arbitrary k's in the integers, and we could say if we only want positive k's, we would have alternative, we would have k times 3k plus 1 over 2. Okay, so what are the first pentagonal numbers? If I have 1, 1 times 2 over 2 is 1. Next pentagonal number, 2 times 5, 10 over 2 is 5. Next pentagonal number, 3 times 8, 24 divided by 2 is 12. 1, 2, 3, no, well, that's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And if we allow that formula, and it's not hard to see that that formula is basically interleaving if we allow also negative k's, or if we, well, if we have k equals 0, we would get 0 here. If we have minus 1, 3 times minus 1, minus 1 is minus 4 divided by 2 is minus 2, times minus 1 is 2. So we would get 2 here. If we put minus 2 in, minus 7, times minus 2 divided by 2 is 7. And so on. I even have the calculations here. Yeah, so the next one is 15. We would have 15 here, and then we get 22. So, That's pentagonal numbers, and we will use them in a theorem which is due to Euler, and in the paper where it was published first time, Euler actually calls it an extraordinary law for numbers. So even Euler was surprised. 5.4. This is Euler's pentagonal number theorem. Okay, part A is, suppose n is not a pentagonal number. If n is not pentagonal, then the number of partitions of n into an even number of distinct parts . So some of the parts, the parts themselves don't need to be of different size. They just need to be different parts. I just want that I have an even number of parts equals the number of partitions into an odd number of parts. Okay. So, let's look at 6. Six is not And well, the theorem will continue. There will be two more parts to the theorem, which I want to need to write down. But I just want to illustrate what I mean there. Let's look at a number which is not pentagonal, and the example I have is I want distinct parts. Sorry, even number of distinct parts. I really want the parts to be of different size. So, what are the partitions of 6? So, we can have 6. We can have 5, 1. We can have 4, 2. We can have 3, 3. We can have 4, 1, 1. Oh, sorry, whoa. 4, 1, 1. We can have 3, 2, 1. We can have 3, 1, 1, 1. We can have 2 and 4 1s, and we can have 6 1s. Right? And that, I think, is all.
3 2s.
Oh, 3 2s, yes. Thank you.
And 2 3s. Oh, wait, you got that.
2 3s I have. Okay. Now I want to look at those where all the parts have distinct size. So there are multiples. I want those only where all the exponents are 1. So.
What about 2 2s and 2 1s? 2 2s and 1? 2 1s.
And 1s, yes. 2 square, 1 square, but that also has duplicates. Yes, you're correct, but it doesn't. So. Which ones have an even number of parts? That's these 2. These are the ones with an odd number of parts, and in both cases it's 2 of them. Okay, so 6 is not a counterexample to the theorem.
That's comforting. I'm glad Euler was right.
Yeah. But I mean, this is not a result you immediately see.
Right.
Why this? What does this have to do with pentagonal numbers? Okay. B. So, if n has the form k times three k minus 1/2 for an even k, then, okay, and I should probably give names to these 2 numbers. Let's call them for simplicity. Let's call this number of partitions into even number of distinct parts. I will call E, and the number of partitions into odd number of parts, I will call O.
So are we going back to allowing a negative?
Yes, I'm allowing negative k's. And I'm actually not distinguishing whether I have positive or negative k's or which of the formulas I would use, but I'm taking this general formula for arbitrary k. And again, it's not hard to see if you allow a negative k, you can reformulate it this way for a different k. Your k shifts by 1, but otherwise it's the same. So, if this is for k even, then we have e is O plus 1. And part C is if N is of the form K times 3K minus 1 over 2 for K in the integers. Odd, then E is equal to O minus 1. Okay, and that's the theorem. So, well, let's look at examples for part B and part C. So, I claim if I, what's a number I get, well, let's have n not 1, what's the next number I get for an even k? That would be 7, right? For k equals minus 2. Because for k equals 2, I get already 12. So, let n be equal to 7.
For k equals 2, don't you get 5?
For 2, I get 5. I put minus 2 in.
For k equals 1, we get 5. No, never mind. I think I misheard you. Anyway, you're fine. I'm sorry.
So for k equals 2, we get 5. Why don't I want to do 5?
I was wondering.
Don't know why I don't want to do 5. Anyhow, 7 will come for k equals minus 2, right? Okay, so, and minus 2 is even, so we are in part B. So, what are the partitions of 7 into distinct parts? We have 7, we have 6, 1, we have 5, 2, we have 4, 3, we have 4, 2, 1. Okay, that's, I can't, 5, 1, 1 is not distinct parts, I don't care about it. If I do 3, I can do 3, 2, 1 is too less, too little, and otherwise I need to duplicate entries. So that's all the partitions of 7 into distinct number of parts. Which of them have an even number of parts? That's this, 3 of them. Which of how many have an odd number of parts? This E is even is odd plus 1. And the if we want an odd K, what happens if we pick K equals 1? Well, then we got 1. That's really boring. Let's pick k equals minus 1. Then we get 4, right? So, if we have n equals 4 and k equals minus 1. We get only 2, yeah. Why isn't it interesting? There is one partition into an even number of parts. There is no into an even number. There is just one partition into an odd number of parts, and 0 is 1 minus 1. Yeah, so that works. But I mean, it's, and if you want, you can try 12. Take n equals 12, and then you get 7 partitions into an even number of parts, and a 2 into an odd number of distinct parts, but I don't want to do this on the board. Okay. So, even with the example, I would say this is not a theorem which comes up naturally. And, I mean, the proof is not hard, but I have no idea how you how you come up with formulating this idea for a theorem.
So does it do a kind of induction, or like a recursion, or?
No, we are doing a, I mean, in some way, what is even more, we are giving a bijection. We are doing a combinatorial proof. We are giving a bijection between sets of partitions, and just in these cases, there is an odd one out in both cases.
What?
That was
wild.
I would think it is Euler's proof, but I haven't checked. I can't.
Was this just like between forays into complex analysis? What was he?
No. There is no complex analysis here.
Right. Yeah. But like, I didn't even know Euler did any combinatorics.
It turns out Euler was a smart guy and did all the
seven bridges.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I guess he's published in all
the birth of graph theory.
Yeah.
Is that not?
I've never done graph theory. Never done combinatorics.
Yeah.
It's all new.
So. Proof. Construct a bijection.
No.
Yeah.
He's published more than anyone, so maybe probably everything.
Between E and O, with one possible exception. Exception. In the case of pentagonal numbers. Okay. So, what I want to do this bijection, basically, what I need to do is I need to take some partition and make another partition from it. And to describe how I make one partition from another one, let me draw it in a picture, because then I think it's easier to explain. So let's see what I have here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6, 5, 3, 2. So I'm drawing a Ferrer's diagram for the partition 7, 6, 5, 3, 2. Okay. And I will call the bottom row of cells or points, well, probably points I should call it, I will call this the base. Nothing to do with linear algebra, just it's how do you call something which is at the bottom? Donald Trump, but no, sorry. I haven't said it. And so that is what we will call the base. And the cells at the right end, as long as it goes down by I want only partitions into distinct number of parts, right? So it must go back in every step. And as long as it goes back just by one, that I call the slope. Okay. So, what could happen, say, if I only had this partition here, if I left out the bottom two rows, then this would be the base and slope would intersect, and I will talk about pure base and pure slope to mean the cells which are only in the base and not in the slope are only in the slope and not in the base. Okay. Right. And now I'm going to take the partitions of N with distinct parts, and I put them into three classes. So the partitions lambda of N are put into three classes. And it's obvious that these classes are disjoint, and it will be obvious that these classes are all. Class 1 are the partitions where the size of the pure base is larger than the size of the slope. Class 2 is those partitions where the size of the pure slope is greater or equal than the size of the base. And class 3 is the rest.
What did you say? What does the pure mean?
The pure means if base and slope intersect, I'm not counting the point where they intersect.
And then so slope is just like the first things that are in a row.
The slope are the cells at the end of the first rows as long as the length of the rows always goes back by one. And I'm sorry, the definitions are slightly long, and to write the sentences on the board where you have the notes has probably relatively little value, unless you want to laugh about my handwriting. Okay. So, that these two classes are disjoint is pretty obvious to see, right? Because the size of the pure slope is equal or smaller than the size of the slope. And similarly for the pure base. So these are disjoint. And by making a class of the rest, I have clearly covered everything. That makes classifications very easy if you have a category other, not one of the above. Okay. And I mean, that's basically the problem of any filing system or any idea. If you're trying to cleaning up things, you will end up with tons of stuff which will not fit in, unless you have something like bank statements or so, which very clearly come into categories you know before. But if you want to file email or something which comes, it will not come in the categories you have thought before. And so you will always end up with a big pile of rest. And that will dominate everything. But not here. Okay. So. What I now want, now I want to build a bijection. Let's take a partition in class 1. So, for lambda in class 1, I want to create a new partition. Create new partition mu by removing the slope and putting the slope below the bottom row as a new base. And I mean the full slope. This might be a point which is also in the base. But because the pure base is longer than the slope, that will, well, first I'm taking some points off and I'm putting the points back in. So this will still be a partition of n. Right? Next, for that partition, I claim it will be a partition into distinct parts. Why is that? Well, the parts which involve the slope after taking the slope away, they are still of distinct size. Right? Then either that row was already the base, but I've removed, then I don't have to deal with it. Or if the base was lower, it had to be because the slope ended, I had to step back by at least two, which means that even if I take one away, these two are still different. Okay, so where the slope is removed, it's fine. The step from slope to where there is not slope is fine. So the only other thing which is could be happening is what happens where I add the former slope below the existing base as a new base. Well, then, after removing the slope, what remains is the pure base. Well, the pure base was strictly longer than the slope. So what I put below is strictly less. That means that is also fine. So it is a partition into a distinct number of parts. Good. So it will be a partition, and these are the partitions, I should say, into distinct numbers of parts. So mu is also one of these partitions where we care about here. In which class does mu lie? Well, the pure base of mu is the old slope, right? What is the new slope? The new slope is at least as long as the old slope, right? Because where the old slope is moved away, this is still new slope. So the only thing which could be happening is that the slope gets longer. Because what it would be actually here if I removed that slope, then the new slope would be longer. Right? So, in the new partition, the new slope is at least as long as the old slope, and the new base is as long as the it was exactly the old slope. So, the new slope is at least as large. So, the new slope is at least as large as the new base. And if the new slope, if the new pure slope was shorter, if the new pure slope intersected with a new base, that can only happen if the slope actually got strictly longer. Right, because I'm putting this underneath, then somehow the slope would need to go further on, like here. So the new pure slope is at least as large as the new base. That means mu is in class 2. Okay. Right. For a partition mu in class 2, create a partition lambda of n in class 1. How? By removing, and in which class would this partition be? The pure slope is greater or equal than the length of the base. So this is a partition in class 2. Take the base, remove it, and attach it as a new slope. Why can I do this? Because the pure slope is at least as long as this base. So if I take the base away, the then slope, which is the pure slope, will be at least as long, and I can attach all the elements from the base there and make a new slope, which might be shorter. But I can certainly place all of them. So, remove base, attach as new slow. So, what do I know then about the length of the new slope and the new base? Well, what can I tell about the new base? The new base has to be longer than the old base, right? Because I have a partition into distinct parts. So the new base is strictly larger than the length of the old base. And the new slope is the old base. That means this will be a partition in class 1. Okay. Right. So, what I can do there is I can somehow switch. So I have a process where I can move partitions from class 1 into class 2 and partitions from class 2 into class 1. That means class 1 and class 2 have the same size. And these are mutually inverse operations. Yeah. Yeah, that is easily seen from what we're doing. If you do first this and then this, or first this and then this, you're back at these are mutually inverse. These operations are mutually inverse. That means the size of class 1 is equal to the size of class 2. Okay. What do these operations do with the number of parts? They change them by 1. Yeah? So, what I claim is, so the changed number of parts is changed by 1. So, what I claim, therefore, if I look at class 1 union, class 2 contains the same number of permutations with an even number of parts as it contains partitions with an odd number of parts. Partitions with odd number of parts. Right? You split up, there are a certain number of evens in here. This is exactly the number of odds in here, and the number of odds in here is exactly the number of evens in there. And by taking the union, we even that out. So, as far as the counting is concerned, class 1 and class 2 together give the same number of partitions into even number of parts as partitions of into odd number of parts. So any difference can only come from class 3. Okay. Class 3, the rest. So, what partitions are in class 3? Well, if base and slope are not intersecting, base is pure base and slope is pure slope, right? And then this obviously covers both cases. If I have two numbers, either A is bigger than B or B is greater or equal than A. So, what do I know for class 3? Base and slope intersect. And what can I tell about the number of cells? What I claim is the base, the size of the base, is equal to the size of the slope, or the size of the base is equal to the size of the slope plus 1. Okay. Why is this the case? Well, so if they intersect and size of the base is equal to the size of the slope, then the pure base, because the intersect is shorter than the base, and or in both cases, yeah, sorry, why is this? So in both of these cases, if the base is, yeah, so if the base was more than size of slope plus 1, even if they intersect, then the pure base would be longer than the slope. Then they would be in this part, class 1. If the size of the base was strictly less than the size of the slope, even if they intersect, then the pure slope would be at least as long as the base, they would be in class 2. Right? So that's why we have this situation. So we will have the partition and we have base and slope intersecting. And what we incidentally have here is some kind of badly drawn pentagon. Okay. So, do you mind if I run over by 2 or 3 minutes, because then the proof is done? Okay. So, let's analyze such a partition a little bit further. For such a partition, we have k parts, and I will split this partition, assuming it has k parts. I will split this partition, and I will split it either here. I will split it basically that's the vertical line. This is obviously vertical. This is very badly drawn. These three should be vertical on top of each other. So I will split it to have a k by k. That I have a k by k square here, and I have something, and I could look at this here, and that's a triangle with side length k. So that means the points form a k by k square, and 1, 2, up to K triangle. And now the question is just if they either overlap or they don't overlap, right? If base is equal to slope, they have to overlap. If base is slope plus 1, they would not overlap. That might overlap. Might overlap in one. In one column. So, what I have is I have the total is k squared plus k times k plus 1 over 2. That's the square and the rectangle. Oh, sorry, I want up to the longest line is k. Why do I have k minus 1 over 2? Well, for if I have k equals 1, why do I have a k minus 1 over 2 here?
Is that a favorite overlap?
I think it has to be plus 1, right? Or is this the k? Oh, sorry. I have to do both. So I have k squared plus. So that's the case when they don't overlap. Okay, what is this? This is equal to k times 3k plus 1 over 2. And if they overlap, I remove one line from the triangle to take care of the overlap. If they overlap, I have k squared plus k times k minus 1 over 2, and that is k times 3k minus 1 over 2. And that's exactly the pentagonal numbers. And if I have a number, well, but what are these numbers? What am I counting there? I'm counting n, right? And any number n can be, because I can use the same formula, I can translate this formula to this one by allowing a negative k, because it's the same formula, any number n can be in only exactly one way a pentagonal number, if it is one. It cannot be in multiple ways. Therefore, class 3 contains, if it is non-empty, contains exactly one partition. And that partition has an even or odd number of parts. And what is the number of parts? That's k. And that proves the theorem.
So
thank you.
Three parts is one.
Yes. Isn't that a cool theorem?
That's a real.